Ligard, Queen Wei, a woman around 50 cycles of age, wearing a floor-length dark dress studded with numberless diamonds, raised her voice and surprised everybody with her proposal. She did not belong to the circle of those known for their military prowess. Apparently, the individual races are not in a position to keep their stones safe from these robbers. Why shouldn't all of us help? Let's have them behind the walls of the strongest castle, surrounded with all the engines of war at our disposal, and have thousands of soldiers guarding them. Then no one would be able to steal them. Kept separately, they are much more vulnerable. Nate nodded assent at once.
Excellent idea, Queen Wei.
Indeed, Issachar spoke warmly. We might all have come to that conclusion, dear sister. This form of words surprised no one. The two queens, so different in appearance, addressed each other as siblings in order to stress their unity of purpose. She raised her hand.
I'm in favour.
All the assembled monarchs followed her example. Glaimbly and the two elves, however, did not stir.
Wait for Gandagar,
was the only response from the unwilling dwarf. Tiwaloon and Villanoil promised to inform their prince and to tell the assembly of his decision.
By the time Gandagar arrives, we shall have Lutasil's view on this, said Tiwaloon. Now, I should be delighted to see the progress on your new building. Were your builders able to make use of the advice we gave you, King Bruaron?
Malan went past them and hurried over to find his horse, puzzling as he walked. So far, no elf delegation had appeared in his own kingdom to negotiate any exchange of skills. Bruaron, on the other hand, seemed to be enjoying the privilege of benefiting from Alandor knowledge already. He doubted whether Idaslane was still a candidate after the quarrel with Regalin. So he was more than amazed on returning to his accommodation to find waiting for him a letter from Lutasil, announcing the arrival of a deputation. Malan was not at all sure he wanted them in his kingdom.
Chapter 7 Gerdlegard, Kingdom of Idaslane, Early Summer, 6241st Solar Cycle. Tungdil lay next to Belindis, staring at the ceiling. Then he stared into the darkness just underneath the ceiling. It didn't make a whole lot of difference. He might just as well have stared into the fire, at the sun, or into the abyss. He thought hard. He thought so hard and so long that in spite of physical exhaustion, he was unable to sleep. Something was wrong. The joy at being back again with Belindis had not ebbed. In the same way, their mutual avowals of affection and the tender gestures which they had exchanged for the first time in ages, it all felt genuine. But still, everything he did and said had a touch of emptiness. It was like spring with no blossom. Things were growing, but colours and fragrance were missing. And because he felt so absurdly discontented and unfulfilled, he hated himself. He was starting to destroy their newfound happiness, and totally without reason. In past cycles, he had attributed this feeling to his guilt about the death of their son. But that wasn't it. Carefully, so as not to risk waking the dwarf woman by his side, he got up, put on his nightshirt, and left the bedroom. He strolled through the vaults, but even there he didn't have the feeling that he was at home. Tungdil went into the kitchen, prepared some herbal tea with yarrow, hellebore, and fennel, sipped it slowly, and waited for the calming effect that would stop his brain spinning. Just when his eyelids were growing heavy and his head was sinking slowly onto the table, he heard a dull thud somewhere near the front of the vaults. A rotten beam giving way would have sounded different. Someone was busying themselves at the entrance door, trying to break in. Tungdil feared the worst. Calm was out of the window. All his senses were on alert. He ran back into the bedroom, threw on his chainmail shirt, thrust his feet into his boots, and grabbed Keenfire.
What's happening? Belindis sat up. "We've got visitors," he replied swiftly. "Ireheart," he bellowed. "Get up! There's work for your crow's beak."
He buckled his weapon belt on and turned to her.
"Do you think you can help us?"
She grinned.
"What impression did I make on you just now in bed?"
Belindis was on her feet already putting on a chainmail shirt. After a second's hesitation, she made her choice and picked up a hatchet and a shield from the weapon rack.
"Where's the fight?"
Boindil had not bothered to put on armor. He stood bare-chested, his hair unbraided, his beard flowing free. At least he had on his leather breeches and boots, and his crowsbeak weapon shone in his fists. Next to him, Goda appeared, having taken a little longer to get armed.
"What do you mean?"
Another crash came from the entrance as they heard the splintering of wood.
"Right, I get it," Boindil said grimly. "Someone's hoping to pick up a stone that doesn't belong to him."
Either that or the elves had taken the dirty fingerprints on the monolith more seriously than they could have dreamed. But Tungdil had not wanted to tell the women folk anything about their less than heroic adventures in Alandor.
"Let's take a look,"
he commanded, and crept along the passageway. The evening air reached them, and the flames of the oil lamps flickered in the breeze. There was a smell of dew-laden grass and damp, warm earth. That shouldn't be so. It would mean the gate was open, and their uninvited guest already inside the vaults. They turned round a corner and saw that the double gate had been destroyed. It lay in pieces on the ground.
"Has he got a battering ram?"
whispered Boindil, looking around. There were any number of openings in the tunnel they were in. The enemy might jump out at them from any of these.
"If it's one of those monsters, it won't need a battering ram," replied Tungdil.
He listened intently. There was another sound. It came from the back of the section where Lot Ionan's old magic school had been.
"Quick," he called out, sprinting along to the laboratorium. "It's looking for the diamond in exactly the right place."
Belindis dropped back behind the others. She was still grappling with the after effects of her illness. The others mustn't be held back because of her. They hurried on, even though now their numbers were reduced.
"I wonder which of the beasts we're fighting this time," said Ireheart as they ran. "The one in armor, or the device that rolled into the throne room?"
His eyes sparkled with life and fighting spirit. Goda and the new tasks had rekindled the warrior's vital life forge.
"Ha! We'll thrash it out of its metal and hack it into tiny pieces if..."
In a flash, the fiend stood before them. It seemed to emerge from the shadows with no warning and no sound. The sight was enough for the dwarves to know that it was neither of the beings they had already heard described. They had a third variety of monster facing them. It was twice their size in height and breadth. Its body was covered in grey and green blotches like an orc's. It consisted entirely of muscles without a hint of fat. Long black hair hung in strands from its head, where two pointed ears stuck up. The face reminded them in a terrible way of an elf, but instead of their refined beauty, there were dead eyes and sharp incisors, which the creature was baring viciously. It wore only a leather loincloth and carried a rucksack. No iron in its body, no tionium here, no machine this time. Round its forearms were slung white chains, and under them iron bands to which the last link in the chain was fastened.
"Out of the way, groundlings,"
it said in an elf-high voice, its dark eyes flashing green.
"You won't get past us, monster,"
said Ireheart, full of confidence, crashing the blunt end of his crow's beak weapon against the passage wall.
"What shall I call you? You don't look like one of the snout faces."
Goda watched her master in confusion. Why in the face of this terrible being was he quibbling about nomenclature? She had heard strange tales about Boindil, and she was starting to fear they were all true.
"Do you have the stone?"
Tungdil demanded,
as he brandished his famous keen-fire axe in the creature's direction. "Give it back! You know how things will end for you otherwise."
"But it'll end badly, whatever happens, won't it?"
Worried now, Ironheart mouthed at his friend. The monster shook its dreadful head.
"Get away!"
it repeated, taking a step forward. Boindil bared his teeth and lowered his head. His hair fell down over his forehead.
"The old way, scholar!"
"The old way, Ironheart!" Tungdil attacked the right hip, giving no warning, and turned in toward the enemy, his friend following through at his back. A split second before Tungdil's blow hit home, Boindil crouched down and sliced at the creature's right shin. It wouldn't be able to parry both strikes at the same time, and, more importantly, what could it defend itself with? The movement with which their opponent evaded their blades came too fast and too unexpectedly for the dwarfs. The creature launched itself off the ground, sprang diagonally against the passage wall, and ricocheted over Goda's head. Her attempt to hit at it failed, and the robber escaped into one of the side tunnels.
"Hey! It can hop like a frog!" Boindil was furious. "Come back here, froggy!"
He raced past Goda, reproving her for her badly aimed blow.
"You'll be dragging beams again for that."
She hurried after him, her eyes downcast in shame. They took on the pursuit together. The monster had lost its sense of direction in the maze of tunnels, as Tungdil soon realized, because it was running off toward the kitchen. There was no way out from there. They stormed into the room and confronted it just as it was trying to force its way up into the flue. Its shoulders were too broad for it to escape up through the chimney. When it heard its enemy's approach, it came back out of the fireplace and stared at them. A brief shake of the arms was enough to free up the chains it bore. The runes glowed on the wristbands. Its fists closed in a grip at the ends of the chains.
"Look out! It will use the chains like a whip!"
guessed Tungdil, speaking tensely.
"Boindil and I will attack simultaneously. Goda, watch the door."
The dwarves went for the monster from both sides, but saw that in spite of its huge size, they had a cunning and damnably agile adversary. Ironheart ducked under the flying chains, but was kicked in the chest and crashed back against the place where the pots and pans were stored. The wooden door gave way under the impact. Shelves fell out and buried Boindil under the contents of the cupboard. At first, Tungdil had better luck. He too lowered his head, avoided the whirling chain, and heaved Keenfire up with both hands in an attempt to whack it into the belly of the monster. But the creature's other claw shot forward and grabbed the haft. Something extraordinary happened. The axe head started glowing. The inlay flamed up, and the diamonds blazed like tiny suns, so that Tungdil closed his eyes against the glare. The monster shrieked in anger and shock. It had let go of Keenfire and was stumbling backwards, as the dwarf could hear. There was the smell of burning flesh. Hardly had Tungdil caught sight of his opponent as a shadowy form than he hacked at it. The axe, Keenfire, dragging a comet-like fire behind it, stopped short at the monster's hip and was jerked aside. Tungdil nearly lost hold of it. Glowing chain links wrapped themselves around the head of the axe, stopping its impetus. With a great hiss, the magical powers of both weapons collided, and red and green sparks flew through the kitchen, scorching wood and stone alike. And what was worse, the sparks fizzled in Tungdil's beard, burning holes. Slowly but surely, the handle was growing hot.
"What the hell is happening here?"
yelled Boindil, struggling out of the mound of frying pans. He'd lost his crow's beak in the heap of broken pots.
"Magic?"
He picked up a particularly sturdy casserole dish and hurled it at the creature.
"Stop that now, frog! Fight like a proper monster!"
The casserole smashed into its broad chest. With a grunt, the creature spun round and looked at the warrior, who had just found the handle of his weapon and was extracting it from the debris, ready to use. It swung its left arm, allowing the second chain to surge forward suddenly with a snake-like movement. This time the chain glowed dark green and made no bones about concealing its magic powers. Boindil swerved to avoid it, but the creature knew full well how to use its unusual weapons to best advantage. A short jerk, and the chain changed direction in mid-flight, wrapping itself around the dwarf's neck. Iohart gave a sharp, strangled cry, dropped his crow's beak, and fell to the ground. Tungdil pulled the axe free with a shout, and the chain rattled to the floor.
"Get back, or the groundling dies!" commanded the fiendish creature.
As if to back up his claims, the Alfar engravings on the left wristband lit up, and the chain tethering Ironheart glowed more intensively. He began to make convulsive movements, and gurgling noises escaped his throat as he collapsed. Suddenly, Goda was standing at Tungdil's side.
"What shall we do?"
"Let it go,"
he hissed through clenched teeth as he stepped to one side. He did not want to lose Boindil. "We can get the diamond back when it thinks it is safe and has let Iohart go." The green glow faded. The monster pulled the captive dwarf over toward it, winding the chain back round its wrist until it showed only half an arm's length. Iohart was being forced to his feet. He stood swaying on his tiptoes so as not to throttle himself. The chain was hot and had scorched his lovely black beard and long hair.
"Don't follow,"
the creature ordered as it went past Goda and Tungdil. It went backwards through the tunnel, keeping one eye on the dwarves. It sniffed loudly, getting its bearings from the smells to locate an exit from the vaults. Its nostrils were flared wide. It continued on its way, dragging Iohart in its tracks, panting and choking.
"When do we free him?"
asked Goda in a hostile whisper.
"He can't breathe."
"As long as he's still making some kind of noise, he's all right," answered Tungdil, racking his brains for some ploy to use against the enemy.
It seemed Goda was completely ignoring the intruder's magic, which probably had not yet been used to its full potential. Keenfire would protect him from sorcery, as it had done at the Black Saddle when he fought the mist demons. But a well-aimed strike on the head with the heavy chains would certainly cause a very serious injury. The creature had found the passageway leading to the gate and was increasing its pace. With a swift movement, it loosened the throttle hold on Iohart's neck, and he collapsed on the ground, gasping for air. Horrified, he groped the singed beard and hair ends.
"I'm crippled. For that, I'm going to strip the skin off you and slice it into pieces, frog," he grated as he pushed himself up onto his feet. "Your weapon, Goda."
"No, master. You said yourself a warrior never lets his weapon out of his hand."
"Goda, this is not another silly test. Give me your weapon."
It was an indistinct cough rather than a speech. A quiet but horrified exclamation from Tungdil made him look. Belindis was standing directly in front of the creature, blocking its way to the exit.
"Get out of the way!" yelled Tungdil. "Otherwise!"
The warning came too late. Boldly, Belindis was attacking with her hatchet, fending off the spiraling chains with her shield. She was in range for a hit. The monster used its chain-wrapped left forearm as a decoy. Hardly had the blade touched the links of the chain before magic was released. A green lightning bolt struck the weapon, which burst into pieces, showering the dwarf woman with a hail of shrapnel. The shield was penetrated in several places. Belindis staggered and fell first against the tunnel wall, then slowly to the ground.
"Belindis!"
Tungdil rushed to her aid. Iohart and Goda followed him. The creature turned around with a roar, lifted up a wooden spar from the broken gate, and hurled it in their direction. The aim was true and swept all three of them to the ground. They were helpless against the force of the blow. By the time they were on their feet again, The monster had disappeared.
After him,
Tungdil commanded Boindil, and looked at Goda.
You, Sita Belindis.
She nodded, wordlessly passing her nightstar flail to her master. The dwarves ran out of the vaults and pricked up their ears. Moon and stars were shining brightly down on Eidoslain. The excellent night vision they both possessed showed them a still and sleeping silver landscape, peaceful and calm.
Where did it go?
Whispered Ironheart, observing the ground for tracks.
It ought to have left some marks big enough for a child to hide in. There's nothing here. Froggy must have hopped away.
Tungdil could make out a movement in the distance.
It has indeed.
He sighed, pointing toward the west.
There it goes.
Where he was indicating, a figure crossed the rough terrain by leaps and bounds, eschewing the roads and pathways. It jumped over bushes and small fruit trees as if on an athletics training run.
It's taking the shortest route home, Tungdil ventured. Wretched devil creature.
Boindil stamped on the earth in anger.
Why the west?
Why not the west? Countered Tungdil. We know nothing about it, or its two siblings.
West is as good as east. Yes, but I thought it would head for Toboribor. The caves of the old realm of the snout-faced orcs would make an excellent hiding place. Maybe it's trying to trick us.
He couldn't make the figure out any more. The dark edge of the forest had swallowed it up and was providing all the cover it might want. Ironheart shouldered the weapon he had taken from Goda.
Shall we get after it?
There's no point. Did you see how fast it was travelling? No rider could overtake it. They returned to the vaults.
We'll look for tracks in the morning. Perhaps they'll lead us somewhere we can find out more about these monsters. I will let Prince Malin know what has happened, so that he can send us a squad of soldiers.
Goda had levered Belindis up into a sitting position. There was blood streaming down from her many wounds. One long, thin metal fragment had narrowly missed her right eye, and now jutted out of her skull. She was biting her lips, so as not to scream with the pain. She grabbed Tungdil's hand, desperate for his help.
You'll be fine, he said to her cheerily.
Ironheart pointed out a large red stain under the chainmail.
That looks bad. We need a healer right away to look at these wounds and remove all the splinters.
He spoke in a hushed voice so that Belindis wouldn't hear. She pulled her husband nearer.
I'm going to pass out, Tungdil, she managed to say. Only Vrakas knows whether I shall wake again, so you must listen to me.
The grip of her hand was so tight that it hurt him. She was racked with a wave of pain, and then her eyelids fluttered.
Chirun,
she groaned. Then her body went limp.
Horrified, Tungdil listened for her heartbeat.
It's still beating, he said in relief. Quick, Ironheart! We'll carry her to her bed. Goda, run to the settlement and fetch a healer. No matter what he's in the middle of, just bring him here.
Yes,
she nodded eagerly, but smiled when she saw Boindil's mistake. To pick up Belindis by the feet, he had leaned the night star against the passage wall. She grabbed her weapon.
Now, master, it'll be your turn to drag the beam today. You know where I've left it,
she called out cheekily, and raced away. He watched her go.
Water!
He spared himself the rest. With Belindis resting on her bed, and with most of the sharp-edged iron splinters removed carefully by Tungdil, the healer arrived to look after her, and calm was restored. Tungdil made use of the time to search the laboratorium to ascertain the unwelcome truth. Like many of the rooms he passed, it had been totally ransacked. Not a shelf was left in place. He soon came to the conclusion that the creature had found the diamond by chance. There was a huge bloodied footprint by the pile of glass. It must have stepped on the shards, injuring its foot, and then must have noticed the diamond amongst the shattered fragments.
"Damnation!" he shouted in anger.
He went into Lot Ionan's old study, where there was an immense collection of books. He sat at the desk and started a letter to Prince Malin, telling him what had happened. He found himself occasionally picking his nose with the end of the quill pen, a bad habit from the old days, the not-so-very old days. He rapped himself on the knuckles, took a new nib and started again. There was a knock on the door, and the healer stepped into the room. He was wearing a dark grey robe over his white nightshirt. His boots were still undone. Goda really had dragged him from his bed.
"Excuse me, Master Goldhand." He ran his hands through his medium-length grey hair, which was standing up around his head. "I'm done here. I've stitched the wounds and treated them with salves. She will recover. The tincture I have given her will let her sleep for 2 orbits.
Tungdil nodded to him, reached into the drawer of the desk, and took out a gold coin.
"This is for your trouble," he said. "In the morning, please bring me anything else she may need."
"Thank you, Master Goldhand."
The healer took the money, then looked at the dwarf.
"What happened, if I may ask? It looks as if a horde of orcs had broken in."
"You may ask," replied Tungdil shortly, but he preferred to keep the truth to himself. There were already too many rumours circulating in Girdlegard. "Thieves! We chased them off. I'd prefer it if you'd keep this to yourself. If anyone asks, say it was an accident."
He threw him a second coin.
"Of course, Master Goldhand. You may rest assured on that count. I wish your lady wife a speedy recovery."
The healer bowed, and as he did so, the sides of his robe swung gently under him.
"Make sure she has bed rest for at least 40 orbits.
"Why?"
He indicated to his right side.
"One of the largest fragments has damaged an internal organ, as far as I can see. But I specialize in healing humans and not dwarfs. It looks all right, but as I said..."
"She will remain in bed."
Tungdil nodded for him to go.
"Thank you."
The man turned and left the room. Tungdil was finishing his letter to Malin when Ironheart came in. He had put on his leather jacket and chainmail now.
"Belindis is fast asleep," he reported,
settling into the armchair by the fireside. With his short hair and ruined beard, he looked very odd.
"What next?"
"We'll see at sunup," Tungdil replied, as he signed the letter and placed his seal on it. He did not hold out much hope that they would find the creature, but said nothing.
"Look what Froggy has done to me. I'm like a plucked chicken,"
Ironheart complained, tugging at the remains of his beard. He had trimmed its ragged edges so that, although very short, it still looked reasonably tidy. It would be many cycles before it was back in all its glory. And his hair was only shoulder length now.
"I'll be laughed at. If for nothing else, he deserves to die for doing that."
He put his feet up.
"Do you think it's maybe always the same creature, but appearing in a different guise each time?"
"Hard to say."
"I don't think so."
Tungdil was chewing over his wife's last word before she fell unconscious. He told his friend about it.
"Jeroen? Old Tin Man?"
Ironheart thought back to the Andekai's huge bodyguard.
"Did she mean Froggy was one of those? It was the right size, and that was from the Outerlands too."
"No, I don't think they're related. This creature bled like an orc. Jeroen's blood was bright yellow."
"Mmm," said the warrior at a loss. "Then I've no idea what she could have meant." "Of course!"
Tungdil clapped himself on the forehead with the flat of his hand.
"Jeroen's armor!" "But it wasn't wearing any armor," retorted Ironheart. "No, but those wristbands and the chains.
Tungdil frowned into the flames. I think Belindis was trying to tell me that they were made of the same metal as Jerun's armor. Do you remember? It carried the magic. He stood up and came over to join his friend at the fireside.
That must mean that others have got the formula.
More than that, Boindil. It means they've found a way to store magic power to use when they need it. It is more than protection. It is a reservoir that they can have recourse to for stocking up on magic now that Gerdlegard has lost its magic source. In a frenzy, he racked his brain.
And what if it's the other way round?
Tungdil stared at Ironheart's wrinkled face in irritation.
What do you mean? Perhaps Froggy itself is magic.
He stroked the remains of his beard ruefully.
Like the wire the Eoil put leading up to the roof of the building from the magic source. That siphoned the energy up, so it could be used at will.
An upside-down storm milker?
A what?
A storm milker. In one of the ancient alchemy tomes, I read that you can do certain experiments when there's a thunderstorm.
Copper and iron attract the lightning bolts, it said.
Tungdil hurried over to the bookshelves and climbed the ladder to look for the book in question.
Here it is.
He opened the pages. Place the ingredients in an iron bath when a thunderstorm is nigh. Let the bath be carried to the top of a mountain and stick a lance upright in the tub. Lightning will enter the tub and the energy released will affect the transformation. He slammed the book shut again.
With these creatures, it's the other way about. They are the thunderstorm, and the energy shoots out through the metal. There you are, joked Ironheart. That's a scholar for you.
Yes, sighed Tungdil, his enthusiasm failing. Of course, it's only a theory, he said with regret. We don't have anyone who knows enough about magic to advise us.
Makes sense all right to me, Boindil consoled him. Why not tell Malin what you think?
Tungdil hesitated.
No. Why not?
He returned to his seat by the fire. Who knows the formula, Ironheart?
The special metal? Well, Belindis and Andokai, and the Eol, I think, but it's dead.
Boindil studied Tungdil, not knowing what he was getting at.
I wonder how likely it is that one of the Outer Land races knows magic and is in possession of the formula for this alloy.
Now Boindil was following.
You think the beasts don't come from the Outer Land?
There are lots of possibilities, I admit, nodded Tungdil.
But where have the indestructible siblings got to? Radario and I couldn't find a trace of the unslayables on the tower. Of course, that was after the Star of Judgment fell. There was neither armor nor ash, like with the Alpha and the Orcs that were wiped out by the Star's force.
He leaned back. Belindis told some of our people the details of the special alloy before she left the Grey Range. And Thirdlings have spies all over the place.
You're not saying the embittered Thirdlings and the Unslayables have made common cause?
I don't know. Tungdil lowered his head, massaging his temples.
Damn it all. We're completely in the dark here, Ironheart. We'll have to step carefully through the pitch blackness, throwing light on the individual secrets as we go.
Ironheart stood up.
Then let's make a start in the morning, as we planned. We'll find Froggy.
He made for the door.
I'll send Goda to the gate to take first watch.
Have you dragged your beam yet? Tungdil baited him about his mistake.
No,
Boindil growled. But you'll be wanting to set a good example, won't you? Ironheart turned round and stepped out into the passage.
Fine friend you are, he said, quite offended. Go on, take my pupil's side. You thirdlings are bound to stick together.
His footsteps died away.
The thirdlings stick together, repeated Tungdil to himself,
and he cast an eye on the bottle of mead that stood next to the desk, calling to him with its sweet, dark contents. But alcohol didn't attract him. Not tonight. Tonight, he needed a clear head. A symbol on the wrist protectors worn by the creature had caught Tungdil's eye. To be sure he'd understood carefully, he looked for the small book he had in the past spent long evenings poring over, so as not to have to spend time near Belindis. He turned the pages. It turned out he was not mistaken. It was the sign for the elf word meaning to have. He closed the small volume and replaced it on the shelf.
So what did that signify?
He would have to ask Malin and Ortger whether the other monsters had borne elf runes on their armor. He got up and went back into the bedchamber. Dressed as he was, he lay down next to Belindis as she rested on the sheet. He laid his head on his hand and watched her face, examining the feelings that were going through him. He stayed like that until dawn. When Goda knocked to tell him a messenger had arrived with a letter from Gandagar, he was still debating with himself and wrestling with his emotions. The night had made him no wiser.
Gerdlegard, Queendom of Wayern, early summer, 6241st solar cycle. The Curiosum had struck camp overnight. The brightly coloured wagons had left Mifidania at dawn without having put on a single performance. Now they were making their way westwards. A ragged hunchback beggar in a big floppy hat on his greasy hair was searching for something to eat amongst the remains of the cooking fire and the rubbish left behind. Not finding anything to his taste, he headed toward the town and the fish market. He sat himself on a barrel with a good view of the newly laid out port and stretched out a hopeful hand whenever anyone passed by.
Please, can you spare a coin for a starving man?
He coughed plaintively. Nobody, knowing Rodario, would have suspected that the impresario's refined features were concealed under the filth covering the beggar's face. The actor had delved deep into his stage makeup box for the wherewithal of disfigurement. This included putting an ugly scar on the left cheek, applying stains to his teeth, and giving himself a full shave. His beard had gone, much admired though it had always been, a painful sacrifice for the sake of his mission. Tassia and the others had been taken aback when he summoned them in the middle of the night to tell them what he intended to do. There was a sensitive and dangerous task to be carried out, investigating the recent occurrences in Mifidania. He placed the running of the Curiosum into the hands of his blonde muse, not knowing how long he would need to fathom out the Fergus mystery. Tassia had accepted the promotion with a charming smile, and had gone on in the intervening hours to make it almost impossible for him to leave.
"Give me a little something," Rodario begged a rich merchant, who spat at him and went on his way. "No, that's not what I meant. Your snot will buy me nothing. Give me a coin."
He called out after the man, earning a few laughs in the process. The morning passed by. The sun rose high overhead and then sank toward the horizon. Rodario stuck it out bravely in his chosen place of duty. He warded off importunate flies, annoying urchins, and a tradesman who disputed his right to the barrel. Altogether, his modest takings for the day were enough to get him a piece of bread and a cup of plonk. You could put up with poverty better like that. The waiting continued. Twilight arrived. Then he noticed the barge the archer woman had used. The load line on its hull was now well above the surface of the water, so it was travelling to town empty. Rodario made for the port and lay down between a couple of heaps of coiled rope opposite the freight quay. He looked like a beggar who had found a corner for the night. Nobody would be suspicious.
It wasn't until darkness fell that the brown-haired woman appeared, wearing a black mantle over her shoulders. Beneath it, Rodario espied a dark, tight-laced dress and a dagger as long as a man's forearm hanging from her belt. She looked familiar, but he couldn't place her. She walked over to the deck, jumped elegantly onto the quayside, put finger and thumb into her mouth, and issued a deafeningly shrill whistle. Near to where Rodario lay, a warehouse gate opened. Light cascaded onto the cobblestones, and a man dressed in a brownish robe came out. He wore a hat, and the chain around his neck marked him out as a member of the Merchants' Guild.
"Kia! Back so soon?"
He was about to go over to her when he caught sight of the apparently sleeping form of the beggar.
"Oi, scum!"
Rodario did not move, hoping to be left in peace, but he was kicked in the side and cowered in a heap groaning.
"Up with you, you tramp! Sleep it off somewhere else!"
The man leaned down and punched him on the back of the neck.
"Can't you hear? I'll get a knife to help you."
Rodario could hardly not react to that threat. He struggled up, drunkenly protesting, and slouched off along the warehouse wall to turn into the narrow space between this building and its neighbor. He had to force himself into the gap.
"You may have driven me off, but you haven't got rid of me," he murmured.
Making use of the slits between the wooden boards, he climbed up onto the roof, hoping to overhear their exchange from above. He worked his way forward to a ventilation cover, which he managed to open and then slip quietly inside. He landed in the dark on something soft that gave a bit under his weight. The smell and slight crunch told him it must be sacks of corn. The store was stuffed up to the roof with it, as if Mifidania were planning for a famine or a siege. Rodario wormed his way across and stopped where he could see a shimmer of light, pressing his face to the slight gap to see what was happening. He had missed the beginning of their conversation.
"And how much would that be, Diefrick?"
the woman called Kia was asking, as she leaned against one of the roof posts. The man pointed round the warehouse, which was bare, except for a few loose grains of corn and some dirt.
100 sacks? Look around you, Kia. There's hardly any grain in the whole town."
She gave a false smile. Again, Rodario felt he knew her from somewhere.
"Only because you have bought it all up, Diefrick, to force the price up."
"Me?"
he said indignantly. Even a fool would have seen through the exaggeration. Kia looked up, taking out her dagger and holding it point upwards.
"Suppose I were to go up there, what do you think I would find?"
"Not much,"
Diefrick lied with a grin, not attempting to look particularly convincing.
"Let's say 10 weighan coins for each sack?"
Kia gave an ugly laugh.
"You despicable cutthroat," she said with a threatening undertone, lifting her index finger. "I'll give you 1 coin.
Diefrick wiped his chin with his sleeve.
"No, Kia. I know you have enough. So you will pay."
To be on the safe side, he put his hand on the handle of the short sword that he carried at his back on a belt. Perhaps this was an agreed signal. Rodario heard footsteps. 2 men approached Diefrick from left and right, wearing leather armor and carrying long swords. They had the air of mercenaries, or at least former soldiers. Kia did not even look at them.
"All right. Let's say 9 coins per sack," said Diefrick haughtily. "I can get you the grain by daybreak."
He held his hand out.
"But only if I get the gold now. And I won't mention the other things you buy from me."
Kia put down her finger.
"You have become greedy," she said quietly. "You are abusing my trust."
Diefrick shrugged his shoulders.
"I'm a trader. Where there is a business opportunity, I take advantage of it. Nobody gives me anything for free."
"I understand you all too well. You would never get anything from me either, without paying for it."
She gave a cautious movement, so as not to give the soldiers cause to step in. fetching a small bag out from under her mantle. She opened the cord tie, put her hand in, fished around and pulled out a coin to give to Diefrich. 1 of 50 gold pieces. I do not have any more on me. He took the bag, then the proffered coin.
So, you will receive 5. Let's say 6 sacks, he said, biting on the gold to test its worth.
A splintering noise was audible. Diefrich yelled out in surprise, spat, and collapsed to the ground. He lay convulsed, throwing himself from one side to the other, then finally remained still. One of his hired soldiers bent over him.
Nothing to be done, he said calmly, and regarded the imitation coin. It had a thin center of lead, surrounded by glass and covered in gold leaf. A clear liquid dripped out of the remains. At first glance, it was no different from any real coin.
What sort of poison is that?
She lifted the bag.
Wouldn't you like to know? She answered, pointing her dagger at the soldier.
The same poison is on the blade of this knife. Be off with you, and keep quiet about what you've seen.
You've been paid by Diefrich, and didn't have to work for it. Be content with that.
The men looked at each other. Rodario thought they might try to jump Kia and take the rest of the gold. The woman's cold-blooded attitude warned them off taking any such rash action. Hesitatingly and being careful not to turn their backs on her, they inched out of the warehouse. She laughed quietly and gave a second whistle. 5 men hurried up to her.
Get up there and see how much corn the bastard was hiding. Get the sacks onto the barge as quickly as you can, and let's get out of Mifidania.
She prodded the dead body with her foot.
Find something heavy to weigh him down with, then chuck him in the water.
Her people nodded and swarmed out while Kia disappeared to the left out of Rodario's line of sight. The noise of boots on the steps announced the arrival upstairs of at least 2 of the men.
Now things were getting uncomfortable for Rodario. He was just crawling in deeper between the sacks when there was a crackling and a rattling in the dark above him with a winch being set to work.
The floor he was lying on descended rapidly. Somehow, he'd got himself onto the loading base, while the mechanism was activated, taking himself and 10 sacks down to the ground floor. Though he tried to hide between the sacks, it was a lost cause. At the other end of the building, he saw 4 long boxes. Kia was standing in front of one of them. She had opened the lid and was looking at some blocks of iron. To Rodario's eyes, it looked like a mass of casting moulds.
"Hey, watch it! There's a tramp!"
yelled one of the men up at the hoist.
"I'm on my way! Don't worry! Just needed a place to sleep!"
Rodario coughed and crawled over toward the door. He didn't want to give up his disguise. Perhaps he would need the element of surprise more urgently. Kia closed the boxes and stood herself calmly in his path, keeping the dead body of the tradesman from his view.
"Not so fast, old man,"
she addressed him, not harshly. Rodario read it as a good sign that she wasn't brandishing her dagger and that no one was manhandling him. His masquerade seemed to be holding up.
"Oh, mistress, forgive me. Don't call the watch, please don't,"
he begged, dribbling and slobbering to make himself even more unsavory. He didn't want her to expend any time on him.
"They hate me."
She measured him with a glance.
"You know, Diefrich?"
Rodario gave it some thought.
"No. Does he belong to the watch?"
One of Kia's people came over and grabbed him by the arm.
"Kia, you know what has to be done. He's seen us now."
"I see a lot of people in Mifidania,"
said Rodario in an old man's falsetto. He laid his hand on the man's arm.
"It's not a crime, young man,"
he announced argumentatively.
"No,"
Kia fingered the handle of her dagger.
"Seeing us, old fellow, is certainly not a crime. But it is bad luck."
She drew her weapon and stabbed quick as lightning. Rodario had been expecting the blow, so moved quickly to the side, grabbing the other man and using him as a shield. He hadn't counted on the old tramp being so strong. He it was that received the stab in his ribs. The dagger did not go through to the internal organs. It did not need to. The poison brought the man down.
Surprised, huh?
Rodario walloped Kia on the nose and she fell back with a scream. He ran off to the nearby door, pursued by shouts from the men and curses from the woman. Even if it had been a long time since he had been in Mifidania, he still knew his way about. He shook off his two pursuers in the confusion of the port. But then he made a beeline for the warehouse again, after first making a wide circle to throw them off the scent. He wanted to see what had been happening following his bold escape. He watched from behind a fishing boat on the other side of the quay. Swiftly, the men loaded the sacks onto the barge, even Kia helping with the task. They must have needed the corn so badly they could not leave it behind despite the incidents with the tradesmen and the mercenaries. 100 sacks was a lot of corn. You could feed a small army with that. But where could an army be encamped in a land like Wayan that was mostly water? And what would be the point? Soldiers who had deserted and were trying their hand at piracy and making sure of provisions before setting off? Where did they get so much gold? What was Fergus up to with them? Questions on top of questions, and nobody to give him any answers, of course. Once the boxes with the iron moulds were loaded, the barge pushed off, not using any lights. Rodario decided to carry on following them. Water, the goddess Elria's element, was not going to deter him. He found a little dinghy tied up at the quayside. Borrowing it, he hopped in, and found to his delight it obeyed even his landlubber efforts. Luckily, the barge was not moving fast, so it was easy to keep up. It was heading for the centre of the huge body of water that now made up Wayan. The waves glittered in the light of the stars, as if enchanted. Rodario kept his distance and tried to hoist the sail on the small mast. It was difficult, but he managed it. Not having a seaman's training, he was not doing very well about holding to a course. The barge disappeared behind the cliffs of an island, and it took him some time to get his borrowed boat to go in the same direction. Before rounding the rocks, he heard a splashing, hissing, gurgling noise, as if a red-hot shooting star had fallen from heaven into the waters. The surface of the lake was very rough. Small waves rolled over the bow of the boat, threatening to swamp the dinghy. Rodario rounded the cliffs. He did not have long to wait.
For heaven's sake, what in the name of all the bad actors in Girdlegard, where the hell is it?
Rodario stood up, his hands on his hips, and stared at the lake before him. Stared at the empty lake. There was nothing to see and nothing to pursue. The barge had disappeared from one moment to the next.
How can that be, Palandiel? He said,
trying to keep his balance in the rocking boat. The moonlight showed him that there was nothing but the islands, and they lay over a mile away to his left.
Has Elria drawn them down to the depths because of their dreadful deeds?
A new, shuddering movement disturbed the surface, and a mighty wave rolled toward him in the form of a foaming black wall, blotting out the moon and the stars.
Oh, merciful Elria, what have I done to enrage you?
He murmured, motionless with terror, clinging to the mast of his small boat before the craft was seized by several tons of water and he was dragged under. Girdlegard, Red Mountain Range, Kingdom of the Firstlings, Early Summer, 6241st Solar Cycle. In these times, when the children of the smith had to be more watchful than ever as they stood guard at the entrances to Girdlegard, it was harder for wanderers and merchants alike to overcome the suspicion that met them at any of the 5 gates. That was, if anyone dared to turn up at the gates at all. It was not always going to be the evil that wished to come in. And so it was in the Red Range. the 9 imposing towers and the 2 mighty ramparts of West Ironhold presented an almost insuperable obstacle, even for peaceful visitors. In the area between the defending walls in the chasm that led to the Iron Howl gateway, and thus to the Kingdom of the Firstlings, around 200 people were encamped, waiting for the dwarves to admit them. For the most part, they were traders, but there were also refugees from regions that had been devastated 5 cycles beforehand by the so-called Avatars and their army. Their homelands were still not habitable. Queen Zamtes had instructed the guards to let the groups progress forward 1 section at a time every 2 orbits. In the whole 10 orbits they were waiting, the guards had them under observation and could examine the people, their baggage and wagons and animals in minute detail, watching out for unusual behaviour. Only the ones who conducted themselves well and passed the final interrogation examination at West Ironhold were allowed to enter. They were let into the halls and allowed over the pass. The guards became increasingly restless. Sometimes there would be the faintest trace of orc in the air, as if maybe a small band of them were in hiding, away, off in the distance, waiting for the chance to storm the fortress. Maybe one of their spies was inspecting the fortifications. Amongst the applicants who had got as far as the first gate was a strapping, rough-hewn tradesman, who made a great thing of secrecy about his cargo. On his big 4-span cart, he had square blocks. It seemed they were covered in leather and canvas to shield them from prying eyes and to protect them from the weather. The wagon jolted its way toward the sentry post, and the man, dressed in light leather from head to foot, halted his oxen. He came over to Bendelbar Ironglow of the Clan of the Glowing Irons, superintendent of the guards, and bowed.
"My greetings. My name is Katef, and I've come all the way from Majula to speak to your ruler."
"Why would Queen Zamtes want you to?" responded Bendelbar, a sturdy dwarf sporting long blonde hair, a colourful plaited beard, and a military abruptness of manner that combined unfriendliness with surprise. Some self-important merchant. That was all they needed.
Kartev walked back, loosened a few of the ropes securing the tarpaulin, then lifted the cover, behind which cage bars were visible. Then he motioned to the dwarf to come over.
"See for yourself."
Bendelbar approached and took a look. Inside there were 3 small figures chained by the ankles and in a miserable state. They were beardless, one and all, and looked, apart from that strange feature, exactly like Girdlegard dwarves. The guard knew at once who it was he had here. The news from the Black Mountains had travelled swiftly. The Diamond Thieves.
Brivracus. "I call them ancient children. I thought your people would be interested. They must be related to you, don't you think? And why did you take them prisoner?" "I didn't capture them. I bought them. I bought them off a judge in Adula. He had them arrested for robbery," he explained hastily, so that no one would start to reproach him. "They were very expensive," he added.
Bendelbar watched the wrinkled, naked faces. The sight was new to him. He saw that 2 of the captives were women, but there wasn't a single hair on their cheeks.
"Let me guess. They were looking for diamonds."
Kartev looked surprised.
"Yes, you're absolutely right."
His eyes narrowed.
"So they've already tried it here, too."
He stood up straight.
"Pleased to be able to help you. I'll hand them over to you. Just need my expenses met."
He dropped the heavy canvas again, and the strange dwarflings were back in the dark.
"Take me and my captives to your queen, so we can sort out a price."
Bendelbar wrapped 1 beard strand round his index finger thoughtfully. He finally agreed. He couldn't let slip this opportunity to cross-examine the thieves. History would show him no mercy if through his fault a chance to avert disaster were to be missed. He gave the orders to open the gate for the man and his laden cart. Escorted by 10 guards, they started on their long way, taking several breaks, through the long passageways and halls of the eastern part of the Red Mountains, until the troop finally stopped in a cavern, used by the firstlings as a quarry.
"Wait here," ordered Bendelbar. "I'll have Xamtu sent for."